The United States is already taking steps to strengthen our partnership with ASEAN.
Vice President Mike Pence visits Indonesia. It's Friday, April 21st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us now online for Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China wants to partner with foreign companies to explore for energy. Tides are rising in Bangladesh. Technology and history in Cambodia. New cars in Shanghai. Buckle up, we're getting started right now with VOA Asia. U.S. President, Vice President, rather, Mike Pence announced in Jakarta, Indonesia, Thursday that President Donald Trump will attend three summits in Asia in November. Pence is on his latest leg of a 10-day tour of Asia, and he said Mr. Trump plans to attend the U.S. Association of Southeast Asian Nations and the East Asia summits in the Philippines and the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vietnam.
The relationship between the United States and ASEAN is a strategic partnership. And under President Trump's leadership, the United States is already taking steps to strengthen our partnership with ASEAN and deepen our friendship.
Vice President Pence has many issues within Indonesia to discuss, as we're joined by VOA Indonesian correspondent Patsy Witakaswara to tell us more about the issues.
Well, Indonesia is the latest stop in the Asian tour that is basically designed to reinforce traditional alliances in the region. So as we know, many people in the region have been raising questions about the commitment of President Trump towards the region, how it may differ in terms of the Pivot to Asia doctrine that was under President Obama, and basically just how these traditional alliances can fit in, especially after the America First campaign promise that was made by President Trump. But at a joint news conference with the Indonesian President Joko Widodo, the vice president stated that the U.S. wants to strengthen its strategic partnership with Indonesia. And President Joko Widodo also commented that they have agreed to boost cooperation. I can mention some of the highlights there. The number one agenda was trade. There's a couple of commercial disputes with Indonesia. And as you know, Indonesia is also number 15th on President Trump's trade list, hit list of 16 countries with trade surpluses, which he has ordered investigation on. And several American companies, including Freeport-McMoRan, which operates the world's largest copper mine in the Indonesian province of Papua, is in a long, protracted dispute with the Indonesian government. Now, this case is being followed very closely by the Indonesian media, not only because of the massive amount of money that's involved in this extension of mining contracts in the country, but also because Carl Icahn, who has been appointed special advisor to the president on overhauling federal regulations, holds a significant percentage in the company. So people are very interested in that. Another issue is Google. Indonesia has been dueling with Google for back taxes and also fines running into millions of dollars, as well as JP Morgan. So the Indonesian government dropped JP Morgan as its primary bond dealer after its research analyst issued a negative report on the country in November. So some of these issues are, of course, at the forefront of the visit. And another focus is also, or another potential irritant is biodiesel. So the U.S. National Biodiesel Board has petitioned the U.S. government to impose anti-dumping duties on biodiesel from Indonesia and Argentina, claiming that they have flooded the U.S. market.
So many economic stories tied to Indonesia and the United States. And of course, President Trump has a lot of personal investments in Indonesia, which also is an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is also another focus of the Indonesian media there. You know, the potential conflict of interest, potential conflict of influence. Because as we know, the president's company, the Trump Organization, is very active in Indonesia with plans to build and manage luxury resorts near the capital of Jakarta as well as in Bali. And President Trump's Indonesian business partner, a billionaire by the name of Haritanu, is also an aspiring politician with ambitions to run for the presidential election in 2019.
Counterterrorism is a big issue for both countries. Mr. Trump taking a hard line in many parts of the world on terrorism and extremism. And how does this apply to Indonesia?
Well, Indonesia has always been a very strong partner in counterterrorism in the U.S. And during this visit, Vice President Pence also congratulated Indonesia, praised Indonesia for the moderate form of Islam that it practices. And it says that, you know, the two countries would continue to cooperate in combating terrorism. Here's an interesting thing, though. I mean, many people noted the irony of the comment because on the same day of the Vice President's arrival, President Joko Widodo was dealt a very serious political setback after his ally was defeated by the Islamists for the election of the Jakarta governor. So the incumbent governor, whose nickname is Ahok, his name is Basuki Cahaya Purnama, he's Christian, ethnic Chinese, and he lost a bitterly contested race that was widely seen as a test for religious and ethnic tolerance in the country after he was accused of blasphemy against Islam.
Mm-hmm. And that trial is still going on with the Supreme Court.
Yes.
Very big story in Jakarta, one that we've been following on VOA Asia. Patsy Widakoswara, thank you so much for joining us from our Indonesian service.
Thank you.
Vice President Pence has been to South Korea and Japan so far. He's also scheduled to travel to Australia. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Vice President Pence says President Trump will attend Asian summits. Rare initiative underway to promote tension-free Pakistan-Afghanistan ties. Panama Gate, Pakistan. Supreme Court orders further investigation. Anti-Vietnam fears stoked ahead of Cambodia election. China launches its first unmanned cargo spacecraft. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Beijing is looking for foreign contractors to help find oil and gas under the South China Sea, but expects to meet resistance because other governments contest its claims and any discoveries may bring low returns. Analysts say foreign oil companies eyeing the bids, which close in September, probably worry that their ties to the Chinese maritime claim could spoil their reputation among rival South China Sea claimants, or that any oil found would be a disputed asset. Discoveries themselves could also be contested by other countries, says Raymond Wu, managing director of Taipei-based political risk consultancy e-Intelligence.
The other contesting parties do not expect that China has enough to claim, not just only the difficulty or uncertainty of finding oil, but who does the oil belong to? I don't see many investors willing to get into it at this point.
The state-run Global Times news website quotes Chinese analysts saying that because most exploration blocks are close to China itself, they are stable investments for foreign contractors. China also has a deal with Vietnam over joint use within the Gulf of Tonkin, site of one oil block being offered for a contract. Andrew Yang is Secretary General with the Chinese Council of Advanced Policy Studies think tank in Taiwan.
I don't think that will be a problem because China and Vietnam has already made some kind of compromises or demarcation, tried to divide the territorial water. So if that is the case, I think this kind of exploration was certainly in the Chinese territorial domain.
But one expert told the Global Times that large-scale foreign drillers may still use extra caution because of the disputes. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings for bringing us the story. Happening now in Asia, the China National Offshore Oil Corporation wants to explore for fossil fuels with foreign companies in the South China Sea. Analysts say doing so may damage the foreign company's reputation among rival claimant nations, in this case in waters contested by Taiwan and Vietnam. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Slowly being consumed by the sea and plagued by tropical cyclones, until recently, the fate of the Bangladesh island of Kutubia has been of concern mostly to many residents who have been driven from its shores. But with millions of people in Bangladesh threatened by the impact of climate change, it may prove a worrying bellwether of what's to come. John Owens reports.
It's a short boat trip from the mainland, But the island of Qutb Deer may just present a bleak vision of Bangladesh's future amid accelerating climate change. In recent decades, rising tides have swallowed up half this island, while cyclones have driven around 65,000 people from its shores. With the rainy season about to begin, islanders fear things will only get worse.
Those who had money have left this place, but those who are still here are living under the poverty line. If I had money, I would leave, but I'm still here.
Where Azina's former home once stood, there is nothing. It was destroyed in a devastating cyclone last May. Paddy fields, destroyed by floods, have been turned to salt fields, which themselves are now being flooded as the island's dam is regularly breached. Fishing is also affected. As the rainy season gets longer, there is less time to dry their catches, something that has hit Saba Ahmed's business.
Before, we cultivated a lot and wanted for nothing. But now, as we cannot cultivate anything, we have to buy things from elsewhere.
South of Qutb Deer, Cox's Bazar, a popular mainland tourist destination, is also predicted to be impacted by rising seas. But the threat goes far wider. Cyclones are not a new thing here, and the changes along Bangladesh's coast are driven by a number of factors. But experts argue climate change is accelerating what is happening in places like Qutb Deer. And with two-thirds of the country less than 5 metres above sea level, a UN report last year warned that 25 million Bangladeshis were at risk. The national response is crucial, but one aid group says the international community must take account for the human impact on climate change too.
I think that the developed countries are the most responsible for climate change, and they need to support this effort. The rights of undeveloped and developing countries are being despoiled by the developed countries.
For some, Qutb Deer is already a distant memory. A community of so-called climate refugees has built up near Cox's Bazar, where they continue the trade so vital to previous generations on the island. But one ex-islander predicts the tides will not relent.
I feel the lower land will be under sea one day because of climate change.
John Owens for VOA News, Qutb Deer Island, Bangladesh.
And check out the video to this story on our website at voanews.com. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia. North Korea state media warned of a super mighty preemptive strike that would reduce U.S. forces in South Korea and elsewhere to, quote, ashes. At the United Nations, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley warned Pyongyang not to pick a fight with the United States. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, VOA Khmer Service reporter Sophat Sung has been talking to VOA's Steve Miller about his recent four-month reporting assignment in Cambodia. It's a country that has undergone many changes since the end of the Khmer Rouge regime's reign of power in 1979. But as Sung points out, much of Cambodia has changed and there are some long-lasting effects.
We're sort of at this. Cambodia has changed, you know, from this society that was affected, you know, by the genocide. It has moved quite far from it, and there was just this recent article about, you know, the, you know, how we will look at the current Khmer Rouge tribunal. So I think that's one aspect of how, you know, the rest of the world usually has understood. And it's definitely impacting the society as a post-conflict country and post-genocide country. Now, it has moved quite far away from that. But I think the impact of that and the impact of, you know, the limitation of institution building is what, you can see in today. And Phnom Penh is a good example. You know, it's great that you have the Chinese investment and as well as investment from other countries that's transforming the skyline. But it's also a question of how you do it and what's the right balance. Because for one thing, Phnom Penh has lost some of its heritage.
In what way? What do you mean by that?
As the country develops very fast, you feel a bit of a mismatch between the infrastructure growth and the human capital growth. And I give you an example of traffic especially. I think we are ready to build highways, freeways like in the U.S., but you don't have a strong legal framework as in implementing traffic laws. So you could build a highway, you could build a freeway like in the U.S., but who's going to drive on there when there's not clear traffic regulations yet? People can, you know, there would be like a lot of crashes. So there's a bit of that irony that the country has to fix now. And that would come from institution building. And unfortunately, nothing on that front is going to move until the politics focus on that. And I think there's been a lot of efforts by the government to reform institution. But yeah, so I think that's, for me, is the most important thing and the most important issue that a lot of people think about. You know, you see in the news a lot about land grabbing and things like that. All of these will come up in the upcoming election, and we'll see more.
All right. One last question before I let you go. You say that it's been about a year since you last went back. What was the one thing that you truly enjoyed about this trip, about being back in Phnom Penh?
I think despite all its flaws, I was optimistic coming back by the fact that you have young people that are energetic and that, you know, strive for a better life for their country. And I think that was something that I took away, because once the expectation of this younger generation is the foundation of how they're going to build the society, I have a feeling that they'll do the right thing, you know, at the end of the day. And I think that despite all the flaws that the country is experiencing, this is something you can be really hopeful for.
Sopat Sung is with our VOA Khmer service, and he, of course, spent a few months back in Cambodia as well as Silicon Valley out in California, and he writes about technology. You can find his articles not only on the voanews.com website, but also on the VOA Cambodia website and on our VOA Asia Facebook page. Sopat, thank you so much for taking the time to come out and visit with me in the studio and having this really long chat about your experiences.
Thank you, Steve.
Both in Silicon Valley and in Cambodia.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Australia and New Zealand announced new restrictions on immigration rules. New Zealand will introduce a minimum income requirement and limit the amount of time that seasonal workers are allowed to stay. Australia will roll out two new short-term skilled worker visas with tighter restrictions. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Shanghai Auto Show has just opened. Both domestic and foreign automakers are gearing up for growing demand for electric and hybrid vehicles. They're known as, quote, new energy vehicles, or NEVs. While sales have risen, electric cars still only make up a tiny fraction of overall sales in China, the world's biggest auto market. James Chow, Managing Director of Product Services and Strategy for IHS Market Automotive in Shanghai, tells VOA's Victor Beatty government incentives and China's growing urban pollution are the drivers behind this movement.
As the pollution environment here is fairly challenging, and one of the ways to help clean up the air or the environment is to make vehicles more fuel efficient, and the government has deemed electric vehicles as the best way to do that.
Is China taking the lead on this?
It sure is. And they're doing this via large subsidies for the purchase of electric vehicles. So this has created, over the last year, the world's largest electric vehicle market. And this trend is continuing, but is largely driven by subsidies. And we see this in the beginning of the year, where subsidies were pulled back a bit in the beginning of the year, and this had a large effect, a large negative effect on the sale of electric vehicles, down 45% in the first 2 months of this year.
According to one report I have here, industry executives expect China to ask automakers operating in the country to generate green car credits equivalent to 12% of annual sales volume. What does that mean?
Right now, there are cash incentives to consumers to purchase these electric vehicles. By 2020, however, these subsidies will be phased out and will be replaced by a carbon credit system, where if an automaker produces enough electric vehicles within their portfolio, they'll earn these carbon credits and would be able to, for example, sell them to automakers who did not comply. So there's a carbon credit trading system that's being created here in China for automotive companies.
Now, while so-called green energy car sales have risen quite dramatically, electric cars still have generated little consumer interest. They make up less than 2% of China's overall auto market of some 28 million vehicles sold last year. How are they going to change that?
What's happened is that automakers are building these vehicles to a targeted regulation. They're not necessarily building them to consumer demand. So there's a mismatch there. So we have consumers who may want a different kind of vehicle, but if you give them enough money, we'll buy an electric vehicle. So at some point, these vehicles will have to stand on their own without subsidies, and that's still going to be a challenge.
James Chow said dominant automakers in China's electric vehicle market are domestic, but Ford, General Motors, and Volkswagen will soon be offering their own versions of NEVs. A new documentary from Disney Nature Films is being released worldwide today. It coincides with Earth Day. Titled Born in China, it follows the stories of three animal families, a panda and her cub, a snub-nosed golden monkey, and a rare snow leopard. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film marks a collaboration between the Chinese government and Disney to show the beauty and grandeur of China's wilderness.
The film follows three families, Panda Yaya and her newborn cub Mei Mei, Dawa, a snow leopard taking care of her cubs in the Qinghai Plateau thousands of meters above sea level, and a playful, mischievous, snub-nosed golden monkey named Tao Tao who is dealing with the arrival of a baby sister. In typical Disney nature fashion, the photography is stunning, capturing vistas, forests, waterfalls, snow-covered hills, and other stunning visuals to tell the stories. Primatologist Dame Jane Goodall, who has studied chimpanzees for 55 years in Gombe Stream National Park, Tanzania, serves as a special ambassador for the film. She says that Born in China is not about Beijing or Shanghai or what people typically think of as China.
And also people will come to understand that China is protecting the wildlife, and China has got these large areas set aside to protect pandas and the snow leopard. So hopefully when people go away, they'll have a slightly different feeling about China. And they'll certainly go away with filled with awe, really, and wonder at the majesty of the scenery.
This is Dawa. And this incredible dreamscape is her home. At an altitude of 14,000 feet above sea level, the climate here is too cold for most mammals. But Dawa thrives here.
The cinematographers had to work for months to get the shots they needed. Locations included the Xialong Wetlands, the Sichuan Wulong National Nature Preserve, and the highest mountain plateau on Earth, the Qinghai Plateau. The film is directed by Chinese director Lu Chuan and is narrated by John Krasinski. During the first week it is open, for every ticket bought, Disney Nature has pledged to donate 20 cents to the World Wildlife Fund, up to $100,000. The film opens in the United States on Friday, April 21st, Earth Day. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And perhaps that film will be part of your weekend schedule. We're glad that you made a little bit of time today to join us and listen to VOA Asia. Don't forget, we're available on iTunes and SoundCloud. Of course, we are on our own website at voanews.com and on Facebook at VOA Asia. I'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Steve Miller and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Have a super day.